Blog Talk Radio.
Radio, as you can tell right now. So let's reset it. The program is called Outside Looking In. My name is Bruce Negrin. We're here every Tuesday night, normally from 8 to 9 p.m., but tonight we're going to go from 9:15 to whenever I feel like signing off. I've got a lot to talk about. As I mentioned before, this is going to be freeform radio, but if you want to call in, if you want to get in on the check-in, if you want to send a shout-out to your boy, just give me a call at 773-897-6423. Again, that's 773-897-6423. So what's been going on this past week? You know, I got a whole load of newspapers. I got to change my lifestyle because I'm doing this program. You think it might be easy. Oh, you just get on the air, Bruce. You get on the air and you talk about whatever you want to talk about. Well, it's true. I do talk about whatever I want to talk about. But guess what's going on so much? It's like life. Life is going on, and that's the scary part. Because, man, with the kids, the kids had a birthday party. Ryan just turned 8. Very happy for him. Landon had things going on. We got baseball. We got this. We got that. I mean, I'm preaching to a choir. If you're a parent, you understand what I'm talking about. You know, your weekends get taken up by so much other stuff, and everything gets taken up. And then I'm not even, like, in the mornings, I'm not even getting up early enough, you know. I'm still sitting there sleeping till 6:30, 7 o'clock. I got to get up early. So I can read the newspaper, have some time to myself, because once I get up, the kids get up. They're early risers. The kids are. Ryan is an early riser, and that is a troublesome thing for the simple fact that that time that you think you have is gone because Ryan's around. Because otherwise he'll sneak off and play the computer or get on electronics or whatever, and you don't want that in the morning. It's not necessary in the morning. You don't need it in the morning. Especially, you know, these kids go to school with their brain is mush to start with. So we try to engage them in conversation. We get them going, things, you know, just what's your day going to be out? Read this book, whatever. But what happens there is you want to exercise. You want to read the newspaper. You don't have that time because now it's like once he gets up, Gina gets up. And when Gina gets up, the whole house gets up because everybody feels guilty about her being up, at least everybody. It's just me. So I got to go in and rouse Landon from bed, say, Landon, get up already. Come on. You know, 7 o'clock comes. So all this time that you think you had is gone. You know, and then after the kids get to school, you got a bit of a time between 8:20 and 9 o'clock before you really have to set up for work because I'm working from home for the past year or so. And again, that time, there's nothing, you know, you're getting something to eat, you're doing something else. There's no time for you. And it's like, how early in the morning do you have to get up to be able to read the newspaper? You know, but I'm going to have to start doing that. I'm going to have to start getting discipline back in my life. And that's an interesting thing because I haven't done that in a while. But I have to start getting discipline back in my life, getting up earlier, doing what I have to do. And, you know, I don't know, becoming more informed. I got to read the newspapers again. I catch up. I do binge reading. Best thing that happened to me is that I got one of those Nooks. So I got the Washington Post on the Nook. And so I can read the print edition. I like the way they have it on the print editions because you can scan the pages. It gives you a little bit better feel of trying to read the newspaper. I'm very tactile. I like to touch things, at least the newspaper. And now with these new programs, you're able to do that much, much better. And you can, you know, you swipe open, you go this way, that way, all this finger swiping and stuff like that. But you also can press on the article and it'll pop up. I'm sure you're very interested. I'll stop boring you with this stuff. Our phone number is 773-897-6423. That's 773-897-6423. I'm talking about getting discipline in my life, about reading the newspapers and having time. But I've also found to myself that if I'm not commuting, because I don't commute anymore, I'm not being educated. The thing about New Yorkers that's different than most anywhere else in this country is that New Yorkers don't necessarily drive to work. There are a few that do. There are a lot that do. Don't kid yourself. But there's a ton more that take the train, the Metro North of the train. And when you're on the train, what are you going to do? You're going to read your book. You know, you're going to read the newspaper. You get informed. This is a half hour to 40 minutes that's yours. People are like, oh, I couldn't commute that long. But when you're in your car, what are you doing in D.C.? You're listening to Sports Junkies? Listen to 99.1, you know, the news station that gives you weather and traffic, and every 5 minutes, talk about being overbearing. Every time they get into a story, it's a commercial or traffic. I don't like that. Then you get WTOP, who tries to be a friend. Hey, good morning. How are you doing? You know, don't give me good morning live on WTOP. I just want the news. Give it to me straight. Give it to me straight. Tell me how many killings there were in Baltimore this week, all right? That's what I want to know. Bam. But really, it's like you lose that time and you don't understand it. And how do you get it back? There's no way at 6:30 or, you know, at 6 o'clock when I used to catch a train going from New York City back to New Rochelle, I can't leave this house and go out into the driveway and just read the newspaper. It's tough working from home. You know, there's definite advantages and there's a ton of disadvantages. The disadvantages are sometimes you never go outside. On a particular day, you don't have to go outside. You know, it's why? Because you get up, you have breakfast, you go to your desk, you sit down and work, and you're there for till 5, 6 o'clock, 5 o'clock, or till 4 o'clock when the kids get home, right? And then the kids come, and then the commotion is, and you got all this kind of stuff. So, and the problem about working from home, too, is that when it's 9 o'clock, you're starting to make up some of these things that you didn't do during the day because you had other things to do. But there are advantages if you go out or come back from like a vacation. We came back from a long weekend. It was nice to be able to get up a little bit later. Not really later. Kids were up at 6:30 anyway, right? A little bit later. I got up at 6:45, 7. It's nice, though, not have to get dressed and have to rush into work and do something to build casually back into your own day. But I'll tell you one other thing about working from home. The biggest difference about working from home, and probably the most important, is I'm 1,000 times more productive because I don't have to put up with nonsensical conversations. There, you see that game? You know, people trying to be polite, which I dig and I understand, and friendly, I like it. I like that part. But there's certain times where you don't want to be bothered. It's funny, I was talking about being bothered at home. It's like, how early do I have to get up to read the newspaper? Have you ever been at work? You say, okay, today, Monday or Tuesday, I'm behind. I'm going to stay at work till 7, 8, 9, 10 o'clock. You know, get everything done. And then that hour when everyone's leaving, that one guy comes by your desk. He's like, oh, you're still here? I was going to hang out too. And, you know, get into some conversation about how your boss stinks and this goes on or whatever. It's like, oh, all that time you were going to spend catching up is gone because someone just walked in on you and started taking up your time. That was supposed to be productive time. Now it's conversation time. We couldn't have this conversation instead of talking about the New York Giants. We could have done this at lunch. You know? You could see what's happening. Gina's out of town. She's up in New York City. She's got her meetings for her job. And so I got the kids and I got the house. And you could tell I'm a little cooped up. That's what happened. You know, get the kids out. I worry about the kids. It's an interesting dynamic, too, when you're a single parent. I don't sleep well at night when Gina's not in the house because I'm always worried. I got one eye open, worried about if I'm missing something or so. As the kids have gotten older, gotten a little bit easier, but I never understood when I was 23 years old and I went back to my dad's house after college, or 21 years old, 22, maybe I was there at 28, who knows, but anyway, when I would go back, how I'd get home, I'm like, Dad, I'm an adult, you don't have to stay up for me. He'd always have the TV on, he's like, Ski, that you? Yeah, Dad, it's me, good, now I can go to sleep. I'm like, oh, you should have just went to sleep anyway. No, you know, you never get that parenting out. That parenting stuff never leaves you. I understood it. I understand it now. I never understood it before. And it's interesting when you start becoming your parents, the good or the bad or whatever, but you understand what they're going through, and it makes a big, big difference. When you're responsible for other people, it's a big deal. You know, and how people can take it lightly, I don't know. I don't know. You know, I want to be involved with my kids, but again, how much time do you go in? How much time do you give them? The helicopter parent thing, I don't want to do that. You know, and I've learned my lesson. I don't do it that much. It's like, and I used to pick up after my kids every once in a while if something was there and think, oh, because what happens there, parents don't do it because the kids are running roughshod over them. They just know how much more of a hassle it's going to be after the kid goes upstairs and he didn't bring his plate up to the dishwasher or something like that. You're like, you know what, I'll just do it. And then after a while, I woke up one day and I'm like, hell no, I'm not going to do it. You know, I mean, Ryan, get down here, put your plate away. Comes on down, puts his plate away. Leaves, you know, Landon leaves his towel in the bathroom. He's in bed, you know, just getting ready. Come, Landon, get up, get your towel, and put it away. You know better than that. You know better than that. So I don't know. The funny thing about my kids is I have a hard time being mad. I have a hard time being mad at anybody for a long time. You know, I will be mad at you for a good 15, 20 minutes. Don't kid yourself. But it's like after a while, I can't sustain it. It was almost like to go back to pledging with the Kappa Alpha Order there at Vanderbilt. I was terrible once I got into pledging, or once I was a pledge, and then I became a brother of the fraternity, or a member of the fraternity. I was terrible on the other side. I couldn't haze anybody because I couldn't keep it up. It took more energy than it was worth to pretend or to be the jerk. You know, and once you've seen the jerk from the other side, and there were a couple guys in my fraternity who were. I mean, no one hazed me to the point of physical abuse and or, you know, alcohol abuse. That we talked about a couple weeks ago. I don't understand how anyone could think 21 shots in an hour is a good idea. I mean, I love to drink, right? I will drink a lot of beer. I'll have a couple shots every once in a while, or I'll just have some bourbon because I pretend like I'm a tough guy. But how anyone could think 21 shots in an hour is safe. You shouldn't even be in college because you're an idiot. You're an idiot. Party, man, party. It's like you're going to be done. Even if you could handle it, even if your body could handle it for a while, you're going to be drunk as a skunk, obnoxious, mean, or just getting sick on yourself. It just doesn't make sense to me. And there's no manliness in that. You know, there's no manliness in showing what you can do with alcohol or anything of that sort. It's like people who play games when they're drinking. I don't want to play games. I like conversation. I'll definitely talk, tell jokes, sit around and talk. You know, that's what I'm about. But I don't want to play cornhole. I don't want to play quarters. I don't want to play beer pong. To me, drinking is a casual activity. It's not supposed to be competitive, and it's not a game. Just let me go and do what I want to do. That's sponsored by Budweiser. I guess I shouldn't reveal too much here, but you know, when you sit alone in front of a microphone, you just start getting on a roll. And I told you, it's like therapy. Doing this show is like therapy. You just let it out and let people know what you're thinking. And once it gets out, that's the whole thing. That's the secret to my success. If you let me say what I have to say, I'm done. I won't bring it up again. But if you get dismissive with me, or won't let me finish my point, then I'm just going to keep coming at you. That's where I get persistent and overbearing. But just let me say what I got to say. There are a couple people in my life who understand that, so they let me do it, and that's why we get along. Water's good, man. But yeah, that's that. Tangent here, tangent there. I told you, we're shooting from the hip tonight. We're going to make it up as we go along. A couple topics I did want to cover. And, you know, when I did the show in Nourish Show, I used to say I was ahead of the curve. And guess who is ahead of the curve? I am ahead of the curve. Why, Bruce? Why are you ahead of the curve? Why are you so smart? What do you know? What did I talk to you about last week about there are no more secrets in the United States? No more secrets. Anything that was nice, that was a big event, but nice and manageable, is no longer manageable. Case in point, the Preakness. Horse racing now, right? It's the in thing. The in thing. Oh, yes. You know, everybody took the hats and all this kind of stuff where Rob Gronkowski goes down to the Kentucky Derby looking like an idiot. And, you know, he'll punch me in the face. He'll sit on me. He'll crush me. I know that, and I won't say it to his face because I'm smarter than that. But he's an idiot. That was an idiotic outfit, a plaid jacket with that fedora and those glasses. That's the whole thing about pro athletes, some of them who don't know how to dress, but they think they're fashionable. And that's the other thing about NBA athletes right now. You know, Clyde Frazier, he went out years ago, Walt Frazier from the New York Knicks. And little, I was a kid when he was in his heyday, in his prime, when he became Clyde. But, you know, he had the big Superfly hats. He had the fur coats. He was trying. Even today, you know, he's putting on, you know, checkered coats and things like that. He had his own style. Whether you liked it or not, it's still his style. He was trying to look sharp. But there are guys now like Carmelo Anthony and Dwayne Wade and some of these other guys who dress like freaking Urkel from Family Matters. I'm telling you, man, wearing a plaid, not a polka dot shirt and suspenders. What are you, Kwame? You know, really, you look like Urkel. That's not a good look for you. Not a good look for a 26-year-old man. 6'8", nonetheless. Can't rock the Urkel. That's a nerd. Things that were nerdish should stay nerdish. It's like the world is changing. Hipsters are nerds, right? So now being a nerd is cool. And it's not like I went around when I was a kid, you're a nerd, I can't talk to you. Everyone had nerdish things. But trying to portray them as style, horn-rimmed glasses all pressed up against your pie face with suspenders and a polka dot shirt, that ain't working. That's not style. I mean, seriously, dressing like Urkel is not style. Oh, boy, that would enrage me. And that's a grudge I never dropped, obviously. But I'd get enraged by that. I mean, you get guys like Craig Sager, the white guy from TNT or TBS who does the sideline coverage for NBA, he's always wearing purple suits or yellow suits or something like that. You know, all African Americans can get away with that. Craig Sager can't, but he did it and he got noticed. And everyone's like, oh, I like the way you look, Craig. You know, standing out because he looked like a dummy, but he did his job, right? Did his job. And there's another term, speaking it like that, he did his job. It's like, as long as they're talking about you, any publicity is good publicity. I don't buy that either. I don't buy that either. Ask BP about publicity, right? the poisoning the Gulf oil spill. Oh, it's publicity. You know, as long as they're talking about you. I mean, is that really what everything's become? I saw something on Facebook the other day. And speaking of Facebook, right? Mm-hmm. Getting information from there. But it was something that made me pause for a sec because I saw a photo. It said, stop making stupid people famous. Agreed. So anyway, I was talking about Gronkowski wearing that stupid outfit and all these guys looking like Urkel. I mean, I understood the Kentucky Derby. Everyone wears a fashionable hat and a dress. And Kentucky, I mean, it was the Blue Bloods. It was something going on there. It was something special. When I was in college, it was like the infield just started coming out, where you could get tickets to the Kentucky Derby to the infield. But it was still quaint, relatively quaint. But we're at the Preakness, and I'm watching the Preakness, and Bob Costas, first of all, what the hell does the Preakness have 4 hours of pregame for? What could you possibly be going on? How many people in the United States are betting on the Preakness? Yes, I understand it's an event, but what do you need 4 hours of pregame on two channels, on NBC and then on NBCSN or whatever it is, CNBC, QBNBC, MS whatever? It's like Bob Costas sitting sideways. Oh, we're going to take you to the infield. We're going to talk to the trainers. We might even talk to the horses. Wilbur, I've got the inside post. Wilbur. But what's happened is like millennials or Gen X, whatever it is. And this is another thing I don't understand in the paper. I don't even understand when now we're going after centennials, people born around 2000 who are getting to be 18 now. This is the new target market. Like they have any money. But there's already a study done about them. Oh, they're growing up in the recession. They're cost conscious. They appreciate a value. Oh, shut up. I mean, there's so much analyzing going on that people forget what feel is. And I guess it's true now because there is no more feel because everybody is a machine. Everybody is trying so hard to stand out, to be an individual, that they're all conformists. And it all started with the tattoos. There's no doubt about that. Remember when the first guy who had a tattoo was like, the first guy you ever saw, ever had seen was a sailor, right? From He was in Midway or something. But he had a tattoo of some Hawaiian lady, or I love mom, or something like that. Only bad dudes had the tattoos. And then it moved up to different people getting the tattoos. And then the guy with the barbed wire. And then the guy with some other Chinese symbol around his arm. I'm cool, man. I'm cool. What does it mean? What's the purpose? And then when 19 other people in your sphere of influence have the same tattoo, now it's you're a part of a team. You know, it's a brand. It's branding. It's no longer an individualistic thing. But anyway, I digress. Shocker! But the digression takes me back to the infield at the Preakness. I mean, bands and you know, kids going, oh, they're here for the horse race. They're not there for the horse race. I listened to something on NPR saying how, you know, University of Maryland is happy to help the Preakness, you know, and build horse racing up as a sport in young people. If there wasn't alcohol in a band, no young person would be at the Preakness. Nobody gives a damn. You know, I've been to the racetrack a couple times. It's fun. But really, who's making the money off of these things other than the trainers? Have you ever heard of these winning payouts? It's like American Pharoah paying out $40. You know, more people are losing money in Vegas on the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight than they have ever bet on. You know, no one's ever made a fortune on horse racing. Oscar Madison's the last guy. But anyway, seriously, no one. I mean, look at the tickets of the Kentucky Derby or the Preakness. But anyway, if you didn't have these infield events, which, you know, it's great. It's great. Yeah, pack them in. Pack a bunch of drunk idiots in into an infield on 90-degree days and then watch them get them rained on. And then it rains and you're an unhappy fellow. I couldn't have laughed any harder when I saw that rainstorm open up. And, I'm in Maryland myself. I was like, oh, those people at the Preakness. Not that I would have ruined their day. But you know what? It's just, it's not genuine. Let's go to the Preakness, dude. Come on, man. Come on, dude. Preakness. Drink beer. Do shots, 21 in an hour, and listen to a band. A reggae band or something like that at the Preakness. Like, really? Really? Because, but again, the point of this whole conversation being, how far ahead of the curve am I? I said there are no more secrets in the United States. There were 8,000 more people at the Preakness this year than there were last year. Last year was a record-setting attendance, and there were 8,000 more. That's a lot more. Good for them, you know, making money hand over fist once a year. Because nobody goes to horse racing any other time. Except guys in overcoats. Mush. Oh, Mush bet on them. Rip up the ticket. Wasted talent. Wasted talent, see? But really, I mean, nobody goes to horse racing. Except for the Preakness and the Kentucky Derby and the Belmont. Oh, we got to be excited. My mother-in-law the other day, she wants to come over. She dumped cable. Good for her. She doesn't need that expense. So she's spending money on all these other packages online, like Hulu and all this kind of stuff. Hulu. But different conversation, different day. But she's got to come over to watch the Belmont. She's asking about the Belmont. Okay. For what? And then she's going to root for American Pharoah, you know, like nobody's business. Which I get, because people want to see a Triple Crown winner. That's really a hard thing to do. But it's not like it's, you know, War Admiral or Secretariat or even Seabiscuit. It's not. But she'll be into it, you know, because she's another one who wants to be part of the individuals. Oh, I don't understand what's going on. Why are all the people doing this? Why are they all doing that? And you're buying into the same hype. You know, I just can't stand when people talk out of both sides of their mouth sometimes. I mean, this is minor. It's a minor situation with her on that. But it's just all of a sudden she has interest in horse racing. Take a walk. If you didn't like it 4 years ago, why do you like it now? Because there's a front runner? And what are you going to do after you see American Pharoah win the Kentucky Derby, the Triple Crown, I mean? What are you going to do? You're not putting any money on it. There's no financial incentive for you. Oh, I saw it. That was a great horse. He was a wonderful horse. His mother was a mother, and his father was a mother, and his sister was a mother's mother. Just started watching Seinfeld again. TBS, you know, I got this DVR, and I can record all these things now. So I said, let me record some stuff I haven't watched in a while. I sort of missed that about New York. New York had a lot of shows that were New York-centric, Honeymooners, Odd Couple, you know, Seinfeld, that you could just sit and watch between 11 and 12 o'clock at night or whenever, 10:30 or so. But I started taping Seinfeld, and it's a funny show. It still holds up. A lot of things hold up. The hairstyles don't, the clothes don't, the setting doesn't. But some of the stuff, I guess, has been ingrained in our memories, ingrained in our culture so much that I don't know if it holds up or I'm just waxing poetic and love, you know, have my own memories on this particular thing. But yeah, Seinfeld's a funny show, so if you hear the references, that's why. It's just not out of the blue. Program's called Outside Looking In. My name is Bruce Negrin. Today is Free Form Talk Radio, just like they used to do back in the old days. Radio, radio. I'm on a Mexican radio. Doom, 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 doom. I'm on a Mexican radio. I heard a signal from Tijuana. Okay, enough of that. Phone number, if you're ever interested in calling, is 773-897-6423. Again, those digits are 773-897-6423. I didn't really promote the episode today because I didn't know if I was coming on the air, but I said I made a commitment to Tuesdays. Even though I'm an hour late, coming on the air. Got on at 9:15, it's 9:41 now. My throat hurts because I've been talking too much. What else is going on? Montgomery County, let's get to some politics and some local issues for a moment. What is that? Is everybody turning off their radios? Come on, there's some things that you need to hear. You just need to hear.
Boo!
Wow, come on. I don't like that audience reaction at all. I do not like it at all. But anyway, the Montgomery County School Board. Told you, I might not be scared of many things, but I'm scared of them. Why? I don't know if they know what they're doing. I'm really getting a sense from them that they got this power play that they run the schools and nobody else tells them what to do. I don't care if you're the superintendent. I don't care if you're an educator. I don't care if you know what you're talking about. You know, the people who get elected, who live in houses and meet every once in a while, they run the schools, you don't. What am I saying about that? You remember with Joshua Starr getting kicked out, they weren't going to renew his contract, so he left a bit early. Got an interim superintendent. You know, Josh Starr knew that he didn't have the backing. The school district, the school board wanted somebody new, and the county council wasn't happy about it. They didn't understand why Josh Starr got kicked out. He may have been more of a businessman and an educator. I don't know the real story. I caught him on the tail end. My kids were only in school for a year, and then he was out. So, but what happens here, the preferred candidate for Montgomery School Board, an educator from Houston, not necessarily an educator, more so of an administrator, which is okay because when you have a school district, Montgomery County Schools District is pretty damn large. I don't even know the number of students, but they have 202 schools. 202 schools in Montgomery County. It's a lot of responsibility. But anyway, the guy they chose was 36 years old, and I believe in young people having a chance to do things. But I have soured lately on young people and lack of experience. Young people read as Obama, right? 2 years as a senator, I'm going to be president. You know, I don't know if this guy thought, really believed what he was saying about how he was going to be different. But it's like, guy, I knew that you wouldn't be able to get half of the stuff that you wanted through with your agenda, progressive or not. But any young guy's going to understand. You were in the Senate two short years, too few years to understand how the Senate could block every move that you ever wanted to make. You know, that's the whole thing about his experience. He had none, so he didn't understand, so he was able to go out there, and I truly believe that he thought he could make a difference because he didn't understand the game. Now he understands the game, and he's frustrated as hell, but it doesn't matter. He didn't have the experience to run the end game on the game. So he hates the player and the game. But anyway, this guy was 36 years old. From Houston, Texas. He's the preferred candidate of the Montgomery School Board. He was the head of HR He was the chief operating officer, and he just moved in to be the chief academic officer. He hasn't been there 2 months as chief academic officer, and he's already looking to move out to be a superintendent of one of the largest counties, schools boards, or school counties in the nation. Montgomery County is. Preferred candidate. He meets with local leaders up here. He says, I don't want the job. We're going to have too many differences. Smart for him right away to say, I don't want it. I'm not going to take it. Good, smart move. Why ruin your life at 36 and have 4 years and be a failure? And because the school board, if you don't kowtow to the school board, so it seems, you're going to be out on your butt anyway. They're making moves. They made a power move getting rid of Josh Starr. Whether you like him or not, I can't say either way. There were enough people out there who said it might have been a mistake to let him go. But the school board, you know, they're trying to make power moves, and then they try to fill in their power moves, and they got nobody. They got nothing. They didn't even have a number two. They got to start over. Scratch. They got to bake the cake from the beginning. And what are they going to do? I hope they don't just try to shoehorn somebody in there. And the thing is, the interim superintendent now is the one that all the principals like, the people in the school district like, the workers, the educators, so to speak. The people in the schools like them. And at this particular time, with Larry Hogan holding back funding for Prince George's County and Montgomery County, we're going to need someone to watch the P's and Q's, literally and figured, and literally, and I was trying to be cute here, financially. And everyone's giving this guy a ringing endorsement to stay, for him to stay, you know, not be the head guy, not to take the interim tag off of him, but to have him stay because he's supposed to be leaving at June 30th. Who knows? But, you know, school board elections, the people don't vote in school board elections. You know, people, it's like not important. I know New Rochelle had a school board and a library board election the other day. More of your taxes go to schools than anything. It's one of the most important elections you could have. You better get good leaders in there, good people in there, not someone who wants to fill a resume. And that is the problem with a lot of local politics. They're people who want to fill a resume. You know, not so many on the county council or running for a city position, but the people who run for library board, or they want to be in the know. They want to be down. They want to pretend like they're giving service back. Oh, it's my duty. Or you just like the fact that you got elected to something. I mean, fess up. It's the truth. It's ego. Half of it's ego. Half of it's resume building. Half of it's, you know, that kind of stuff. It's not to do better. You know, I do believe that they think they can or hope they can, but I don't think they're worried about it too much afterwards, because all the decisions made are not really, you know, oh, for the kids. Well, make some tough decisions for the kids. So that's where they're going there. What else is going around here? I was reading in the Washington Post the other day, discussed it in the locker room, my hockey locker room. My hockey locker room is great because, you know, everyone's like, oh, you're just dumb hockey players. I got a lot of smart people in there, too. It's like I'm trying to pretend like I'm the smart guy, but all these guys know the issues as well. Everybody reads the Washington Post. People are up on it. It's like all I had to do in the past is just read the newspaper. But now people are reading the newspaper. They know, and they call you on things. It's like, oh, I read that article. Oh, snap. I better not make up stuff about it. But anyway, what's going on? Baltimore City. Charm City. I was reading this stat since the Freddie Gray riot. I was calling him Eric Gray a couple weeks ago. Freddie Gray, I meant to say. I know an Eric Gray. That's why it was a Freudian slip. But anyway, the Freddie Gray riot since then, the 30 days since then, there have been 31 murders. 31 murders. Not shootings, not incidents, murders. People dead, stone dead in Baltimore. Wild, wild west. And seriously, I mean, the lids come off. Police are afraid to do their job. Baltimore has a drug trade that's just, I don't think has ever been quelled. You know, The Wire? That stuff is true. It's true. I mean, there was some guy who just got killed the other day who was trying to be, you know, he got caught for being a middleman and distributing heroin. But he was a barber. But then he was also helping kids. He got sentenced. He was about to go to jail on his own recognizance. And he was about to go, but somebody called him out in a broad daylight execution. I guess it was during the curfew, so they couldn't do it then. So they killed him in broad daylight. He was a bad guy trying to reform himself. He knew what he did. He was going to jail. He didn't serve his time yet, but he got sentenced, and the judge said he could come on a particular date. But killed in broad daylight. 31 people, let alone the number of shootings, let alone the number of robberies, and et cetera, and violent crime. Murder, man, and people were worried about going to Baltimore. I mean, and I would be. You know, tough guy New Yorker, right? I felt safer in New York 3 years ago than I felt anywhere that I've ever been. Been a couple places I just haven't felt safe. Baltimore has been one of them. Always looking over my shoulder when I'm up there. And people are like, you better get out of there at night. You know, and I'm like, give something a break. Stop running scared from everything. But, you know, you got to run aware. Oh, you don't even have to run, but you just have to be aware. But the places I was the most scared, or one of the places I was scared in, literally scared, was Reno, Nevada. It was some place, I was at the Silver Nugget Hotel or something like that. Who knows? They're all the same. But anyway, another gambling hotel. I was there for a convention. I was going to go to some bar down the block. I keep my wallet in my front pocket, had it in my right pocket, knew it was there. I said, that's about 3 or 4 blocks. Once you get outside of these hotels, on the weekends, it must be fabulous. But once you have, I think I mentioned this before, too. It's like outside of this hotel in Reno, Nevada, were pawn shops and places that sold Lucy cigarettes. Lucy cigarettes tell you that the neighborhood is no good. When someone can't afford a pack of cigarettes, and I'm not talking about New York City where it's 15 bucks a pop, but if you can't afford a pack of cigarettes, or people coming into your store can't afford a pack of cigarettes, then it's time to get out of that neighborhood. Things are desperate. You got to get a quarter to buy a cigarette. Imagine what you need a couple dollars more to buy, right? That's when you get clubbed on the head. So I was outside, it's all quaffed up, had my diamond studded jacket on. I said, you know, let me go back inside this hotel and play it smart. Play it smart. And I did. I was scared in Reno, Nevada. I was alone, didn't have anybody around, you know, near me. I was alone. I wasn't walking with anybody. Like, common sense, my brother. Common sense told me to go back in, and I did. And I did. But Baltimore, really, I mean, they had some comparisons to the district, to Washington, D.C. Baltimore's had 90 murders from January 1st to today, or to about 3 days ago. And Washington, D.C. has had 40. 40's still a lot. But everybody's like, well, the district ain't the district anymore. And it's true because, man, there are a lot of different neighborhoods going along that, you know, that people have decided to live closer to walking and to urbanness. And if you're young, there's no reason not to. There's no reason to live in a suburb if you're a young person or if you're single. You know, like, why do you need a lawn? Why do you need mowing? I mean, if you got a nice apartment complex, I guess, if you got a swimming pool and a volleyball court or whatever, but are you really using them? If you are, or you play tennis every weekend or every night, more power to you. You know, when I was in Georgia, when I lived in Atlanta, Georgia, I did a lot of the city. I lived in the city for, I guess, 5 years, and then I moved out to one of those complexes like Lenox Gables or Camden Crest or whatever. And, you know, they had the volleyball and the pool, and it was fun because all the guys I had working at the bar, so we had days off, so we were able to enjoy the resort amenities. But if you're working from 9 to 5, 9 to 6, what do I do today? I don't know. Just walk along the street. And each day can bring something different. That's life, man. That's life. Remember when I lived in the West Village? That was one of the greatest things. Gina, what are we going to do today? I don't know. Let's just take a walk. And it wasn't the same walk. It was never the same walk. It might have even been the same streets, but never the same walk. Hey, don't boo my singing. Come on now. I'll tell you what you'd be booing. So anyway, Baltimore's got a lot of work ahead of itself. You know, I mean, this is the thing. All of this kind of stuff. Because once you cross the line, then the police don't feel safe in doing anything because they think they're going to be accused, even if it's a legal arrest or a legal bust or whatever. Because now, I mean, they could literally have a guy who just shot a gun off and 9 people, innocent people on the street, and having them pinned down and, you know, a knee in his back and an arm on his head. hey, what are you doing? You know, what are you doing? Stop brutalizing that man. You know, and people just driving by with their cell phones and their cameras taking pictures. They're brutalizing him. Do you know he just tried to shoot kids in a parking lot? It doesn't matter. He has rights. Some of those people who are getting killed by stray bullets. You know, I mean, it's one of those things. That's why you got to back up. Not every cop is a criminal. Not every cop is a bad dude. And you know what? I mean, think about it. If you were on the other side, you resist arrest over and over again. It's a physical game. You're going to get physical, you're going to get physical back. I mean, it's just, I don't believe people should be shot unjustly. But, you know, if people get physical, you get scared. And what do? It's humans in those uniforms most of the time. You know, and again, it's one of these things. It's, oh, you're an apologist, Bruce. I'm not an apologist. It's just, I one day I'll need them. And I'll believe me, you know, in New York City, too. Everyone, not the nicest of police in New York City in certain areas or certain times, yelling at you, what the hell are you doing? Get back. All right. You know, you get annoyed, but you keep your mouth shut, keep walking. Because I'll tell you, if I'm in a physical confrontation and I need someone's help, I don't want to be the guy, oh, these are the same people I was cursing before. It's not going to be me. Thank you. I agree. But there was an interesting thing in New York City. I was reading this in the New York Post. There's a theory out there called the broken windows theory of policing. Broken windows is probably one of the best analogies, best methods out there for crime prevention. What it's saying is that if a house on a block is abandoned, and if one window breaks, people realize that there's nothing going on, that someone else can come and throw another rock through that window, and no one's going to do anything about it. So something that was just sitting there abandoned had a little damage to it, and people kept breaking the windows. Now squatters move in, and then rats come, and it just becomes a condition where it eats on itself, and it becomes dangerous. So when you take that broken windows theory and you apply it to misdemeanor crimes in a city or in a neighborhood or in a county, people for jaywalking, people jumping subway turnstiles, people, you know, quality of life offenses, urinating in the street. When you arrest people for that and you look up their arrest records, because the people who are doing that more times than not are the people who have done more different, or have done more violent crime, or bigger crime, assaults, robberies, larceny. I mean, there were a number of times. So this is a method of policing that came into New York City, and it was Bill Bratton who did it, and was picked up by Sapphire, and then picked up by Kelly and Kerrick and all of these other police commissioners, and it worked. Crime is crime. There is no black and white here. You know, you jump a turnstile, you're treated, you get stopped. It's not a look-away offense. You can't look away from it. Because they were starting to catch some serious criminals with this. What's going on in New York is all these people moving into New York and, you know, progressive people. You have a progressive mayor and a progressive city council who's really taken up to arms saying that, you know, the citizens have more rights than the police. Okay, fair. But policing is policing. You know, the reason you have a say in this is because people, you have the freedom to say it and then the non-fear to say it. I'm not saying police protect your freedom of speech, but they protect your freedom inside a city. And New York City was a bad place. But the thing that's happening now is all these 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds, they don't remember New York City in the old days. It's like being a Yankee fan from 1990. Or 95, right? 1990. Whenever they started winning. And the Yankees started, you know, Derek Jeter's career. Let's just say Derek Jeter's career. All they know is Derek Jeter and that the Yankees were either winning the World Series or in the playoffs. They didn't know hardship. They didn't know the bad old days. Well, Bill Bratton came out the other day in his article and said, the people who are living in the city don't remember New York City the way it used to be. The way it used to be in 1990. 1986, 1991. They don't remember it. So all of these police tactics that cleaned up the city, that made it Disney-fied, that brought Bubba Gump Shrimp Company to Times Square, that made parks that used to be overrun with needles and other illicit things, it cleaned up a city, this broken windows theory, the implementation of it. But these guys don't remember this city. Can you be too young? You know, can someone remember something that they were not born yet into? They only know New York in the golden glory. As someone who grew up in the New York area and who worked in New York for 5 years before moving out to Atlanta and then coming back in the heyday in 97, 98, you know, when New York was the shiny city on the hill. It really was, and it is. But you start reading about these things again and how they're loosening up the police or loosening up the tactics that can be used and more, you know, misdemeanor crime is not a crime anymore. You see what's happening, and it's New York is starting to slip. New York is starting to slip because do you have the right to be accosted by beggars, homeless men, squeegee people? No, you don't. You know, why is that a right? It's not a right. It's my right to be to walk down the street without being accosted on every street corner. That's my right. That's what I live for or live there for. But that's starting to slip. We're in a backslide in New York City. I said this to my wife. I said, when de Blasio got elected, watch out. I said, we're moving at the right time. Subways are falling down. Crime is up. People were not feeling good about New York anymore. You know, it's still expensive and it's going to take New York didn't clean up overnight, and it's not going to decay overnight. But the signs are starting to show. And they're not being addressed. They're being bandied about and talked about and looked the other way. Broken windows? Bye-bye. You know, giving police the right? I mean, stop and frisk. My dad is like, oh, stop and frisk. You know, it's very important. I believe in it. I think it's a terrible thing. Stop and frisk. To just get stopped and frisked? You know, for no reason? For no particular reason? You know, I mean, I'm, according to this conversation, I'm as conservative and as right-wing as they can be, right? At least that's what you can think. But I never really thought stop and frisk was, on paper, it's a terrible thing. It is an affront to your civil liberties. But jumping a turnstile is not an affront to your civil liberties. You can't overlook that. That is a crime. You did not pay the fare. You did not pay your fair share of an MTA that the rest of us are buying Metro cards to get on. You do that, you deserve to be taken over and your arrest record looked up, if there is one. You do other things that are warranted of being arrested or stopped. Not stopped randomly. You did something to deserve being stopped. That I am for. That is broken windows. That is what keeps cities safe. That's what keeps people safe. You know, everyone hates the cops until they need them. Everybody hates law and order and discipline until they need it. I mean, Rudy Giuliani, you could say whatever you want. And this is, it's just funny because, I mean, he was a terrible, but he changed the city, totally changed the city. And then Bloomberg put the icing on it. Giuliani baked the cake and Bloomberg put the icing on it. And de Blasio now is just eating it with a fork and handing it out to the people who felt disenfranchised, the fare jumpers who felt disenfranchised, who felt picked on for the last 20 years. Can't let the inmates run the asylum. And that's the truth. That is the truth. Because I'll tell you, you want to be out of there being mayor quicker? There's no way to get yourself out of being New York City mayor quicker than having a murder rate or a crime rate jump and having people feel unsafe because people in New York do not know what unsafe is. I feel safe in New York. I felt safe for a long time. And I mean, I was a New Yorker. I lived there, lived in Brooklyn, lived in the West Village, lived on the Upper West Side, worked in Manhattan before I lived in the city. when I was gathering up my donuts to buy a place or to get a place in the city. Working for a rap music label. So, I mean, I've been everywhere. I've cross-cultured everywhere. So, I don't want to hear that much kind of stuff. So, it's just, New York City, it's on the precipice. It's in a precarious situation, and it could slide both ways. And we're talking about Giuliani anyway. I mean, in 9/11, just the point of it, whether you like Giuliani or not, it's not about politics. It's about management style. And he informed people. He gave people who were needed information in a particular time of panic, and he tried to calm them by giving them information. It worked for me, worked for a lot of other people, and that's what made him something special. And even Governor Pataki knew to step aside for a little bit. His Rudy show, there was no reason for politics in there, and that's what I appreciated about that particular setup at that time. Pataki didn't, the governor of New York State didn't run politics on it. Because I'm sure if something happened in New York now, Cuomo would be punching de Blasio and kicking him to the back, standing next to the sanitation commissioner while Cuomo answered all the questions. But de Blasio, this guy's around the country running around with his progressive agenda. Fine. But really, in the history says that New York City is a mayor of New York City is a dead end job. Mayor of New York City for as long as you want, quite possibly, but you're not going anywhere else. And I said it last week, I'll say it again. Just read Ungovernable City, The Story of John Lindsay, and you're going to see de Blasio's story all over again. And how nobody is picking up on this, I don't understand. Nobody is picking up on the parallels here. You go out there. So when in a couple weeks, when I read the article that says de Blasio and Lindsay, when it mentions the same two people in the same article, you will know that I am the trendsetter, that I am ahead of the curve. I am so far ahead of the curve that I could look around it and see myself again. That's how far ahead of the curve I am. I'm like one of those trains that's in the front, and you can see it still turning in the back. I got it going on, man. I really do. I really do.
Fredo, you're my older brother, and I love you. But don't ever take sides with anyone against the family again. Ever.
I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you, I make you laugh. What do you mean funny? Funny how? How am I funny?
That was a great scene, huh? But that's what you think. You think I'm a clown? Think I'm funny? Funny how? Clown funny? All right, Spider, get me a drink. One other thing I want to talk about. There was an article that I didn't get to a couple weeks ago. It's again out of the New York Post, the Washington Post. Everything's the Post. Just send it. If it says Post in it, just send it to me, because I'll read it. Post Gazette, Post Dispatch, just send it. Washington Post, New York Post, Scratching Post, Barber Post. But anyway, the Republicans in Maryland are getting all fired up. They're starting to flex their muscle. They're like, yeah, Larry Hogan is the governor. Got a Republican governor. Let's revitalize the party. Revitalize. We'll get out there. We'll win state seats. We'll do everything. Hold up. I mean, sometimes you got to read the tea leaves, right? People were sick and tired of being taxed. Sometimes a Republican comes in at the right time. The Republican or whoever is talking fiscal sense, talking about cutting taxes, lowering taxes, holding the line on taxes, and being fiscally responsible. There are certain times where that card will get you elected for 4 years. Hands down. Especially when the guy, Martin O'Malley was the governor. Every other day it seemed like he had a new tax, which is true, because he tried to be progressive and run all of these, environmental programs and other programs and social programs. Some of them need money to get done. But then Anthony Brown, the lieutenant governor who was supposed to be the anointed one, who was supposed to be anointed next, everyone got scared that he was going to run the same stuff. Larry Hogan found the perfect storm. He was just, I'm a businessman, I'm an outsider, I believe in being fiscally responsible. Click, vote, click, vote, click, vote. They just didn't. They didn't know what they were going to get with Anthony Brown. No one here knew what they were going to get with Anthony Brown. They said they did know what they were going to get with Hogan. I'm going to roll back taxes. I mean, he did something pretty amazing. Rolled back tolls in New York, in Maryland. Can you imagine my New York friends who listen here? Can you imagine if tolls ever got rolled back? Seriously, it costs you an arm and a leg to get out of Staten Island. The Verrazano Bridge is like $107. One time I added it up to go, you know, with EasyPass. That's the blessing and the curse of EasyPass. EasyPass is great because sometimes you say, well, I'll never get that time back. EasyPass sometimes allows you to get that time back. That time you spent chatting to the guy in the office or whatever, that you were trying to do something else. EasyPass sometimes affords you the opportunity to get that time that you never thought you had back. But EasyPass is also like a credit card because you have no idea how much you're spending. You have no idea what a toll is. I'd be so shocked if someone could tell me what the price of the Verrazano Bridge is. The last time I checked, it was like $15 to get out. I think it was more than the George Washington. It shouldn't have been, but I think it was. You know, it's not to get out. Well, yeah, for them to get out of New York there, because the GW is to get in, cover charge to get into New York City. But you go down, I clocked it out one time. It was like $75 between tolls, between bridges and tolls on the highway, the Jersey Turnpike and all of this other stuff. $75. I mean, how do I get to New York without a toll road? How do I do it in less than 12 days? Eisenhower, your interstate system is taxing me to death. What's up with that? So anyway, Larry Hogan rolled back tolls. Like the ICC, the Intercounty Connector, 200, as we like to call it down here. 200, take 200. ICC. First time my dad came down here, I told him, catch the ICC, and then he saw 200. He thought it was $2. I didn't realize that was the road. I thought that said ICC $2. Dad, come on. But anyway, he's rolling it back, and that's a good thing because the roads will get you. Sometimes if you roll back, people will decide to use it. There's a lot of people in these toll lanes, et cetera, like the new express lanes coming out of on 495 and or on 95 just past Baltimore up to White Marsh. You know, if it's cheaper, then people will use it. So you're going to make the money. What you're giving back is minimal compared to what you're going to get back from it. Like, I got a boss where I work, talks about margin all the time. Makes sense to me. I understand you got to hold your line on margin. You can't give stuff away. But if you're not selling anything, anything at all, what's the point of holding the margin? Shouldn't the machines be running? Shouldn't you be selling something to get the machines be running? At something that's not at a 60% margin, but at a 45 or so, or 50? Come on, man. Something or nothing, especially when you're only in competition with yourself. So that works. That works. So Larry Hogan did do that. Again, man, but sometimes I just, where's this money going to go? Where's it coming from? What's it being taken out of? You know, you can do some of this stuff. Just tell me you're not going to raise anything for a year. That I can live with. You know, I understand about fair share, and I understand about taxes, but I will say this again and again and again. Fair share to me is, you tell me that the money I'm putting in, this extra $200 that you're going to tax me a year, or whatever it's going to be, is going to pay down the deficit alone. It's not going to some social program. It's not going to the military or whatever. It is going to pay down the debt. I will pay it. I won't want to, you know. I mean, do I want to pay more taxes? Hell no. But I will pay it if I know where it's going. If it's budgeted towards a specific thing. A specific thing, then I will pay it. That's how we have to revamp things in our government. You know, you're giving them taxes for these programs, for those programs, for debt relief, for this, for that. I will target the extra money for something, and I'm sure people won't get upset. I mean, yeah, they'll complain. Of course they will, but they won't be that crazy. I don't think they will be. I don't know. Something to ponder. Something to ponder. The program's called Outside Looking In. My name is Bruce Negrin. We're here every Tuesday night, normally from 8 to 9 p.m., but we went on late today. We had personal issues. I had personal issues. let me speak about personal issues for a second. Not that I got anything to lay on you, but I don't want to hear it anymore. I don't understand why I can't root for a sports star or someone without having some back Sports Illustrated story about it. Why has everyone always got to come from hardship and desperation? All of us have lost somebody. All of us have felt pain somewhere. Obviously, some more than others. And I mean, there's stories that need to be told, but it's like, oh, he's overcoming the death of his mother. And hey, welcome to the club, Kai. You know, it's like, wow. That gave him more motivation. I don't understand. I don't understand why someone on the equal plane of what it's about, why someone's thing has to be more motivating than mine. Why it has to be a bigger story than mine. People have been going on hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Grin and bear it. I'm not saying be, you know, don't be sensitive. Don't have a soul. That's not what I'm saying at all. But why is your tragedy much greater than mine? Why is your story bigger than mine? Why is it sadder than mine? Why do you have to tell it? Why can't you keep it to yourself? Why does everything have to be a human interest? The guy can throw a ball 90 miles per hour. The guy can score, you know, shoots 50% from the field and scores 33 points a game. Why can't that be the story? You know, Sports Illustrated is the master of that. And now you got Real Sports and all this other stuff. But Sports Illustrated was the master. It was like the first four paragraphs of every story in Sports Illustrated had to begin with somebody's hardship about something. We all have it. We all have it. Some have it worse than others, and there are a lot of people I know who have it worse than me who I've never heard made a mention of it. Ever made mention of it. I guess we'll close on this. There's an interesting film festival going on in Washington, D.C. now. It's the Vet Film Festival, the GI Film Fest. And they were talking about it. Now, they're tired of two people being portrayed in the military, that there's only two people. There's, you know, there's either Chris Kyle or Marky Mark's role in the Lone Wolf or Survivor or whatever. I can't even remember the film about the Rangers who were in Afghanistan and they all got killed, but this one guy lived. You know, a movie that I don't know if it needed to be made either. Whatever. But they were saying, you know, the American hero, it's either too patriotic, there's no balanced story to it. You know, and Ethan Hawke, an actor actually, a popular actor, you know who he is, but he was talking about his dad or his cousin or something. He was just like, you know, my cousin, he's a vet. He comes out, he's like, and you know, I was in that war. You know, it's not, they don't wave a flag of the war or the badge of honor or whatever. It's just, he's just saying that some vets have normal lives. We got to treat them all with respect, wounded warriors, et cetera. And I mean, if they do come home with carrying the war with them, I'm not trying to, don't get me wrong on what I'm saying. But I'm also saying that they're just like my dad. You know, he was in Korea. You know, and thank you for your service there, Dad. But, you know, it's like he was in Korea, got drafted, went over there. It was never really a part of our lives. He didn't talk about it. He didn't dwell on it. He was in Korea. And until he started going to some reunions, didn't really know much about Korea with him. You know, I mean, I knew the story, but I didn't know what it was about. You know, in terms of our life, it wasn't a big part of our lives that he was a veteran. So that's what they're trying to say. They're real people out there who are veterans who have different stories. It's not all the Chris Kyle story, you know, or they're not all war heroes, but they've been there and been heroes for being there. They're just real, normal people. You know, and not every story has to be about a gun and what he did with a gun. But a lot of stories can be told about what maybe the Army or the vet took out of that to make something better instead of always hitting the bottle or something like that. You know, show both sides. And that's what this GI Film Festival plans to do. And that's what I was trying to say. Well, anyway, I think I'm going to wrap up the program. Once again, it's Outside Looking In. My name is Bruce Negrin. We'll be back next Tuesday between 8 and 9 p.m. I'll tell you some Memorial Day stories. some more stuff about the kids, some more stuff about the work. We'll see if we get the discipline for me to get up early, to exercise, to read the newspaper, to do what I got to do. We'll see. Stay tuned to the Same Bat Channel. Hey, do me a favor. Step up to the mic because no one's going to say it for you. And try to do something today that'll make you better tomorrow. I'll talk to you next week.
Hear me now. down, brother. All around the world, the husband and wife work night and day in search of the good life. Good life. Good life.